and Hebrew. They were not literate in Hebrew, and since they didn't know any other language, they were not literate in any of the ambient languages as well. I mean, I'm not saying all were not, but a substantial chunk weren't. And we have to now understand what was happening to both boys and women, and why, to a certain extent, those women who did have an education got a much better education.
How did they get the Beloidim and all these various famous yeshivas?
There was a selection process. How many students were there in Beloidim? 300? 1,000? A very tiny percentage of the Jewish population of Russia and Poland. In other words, it's true, there were all these great yeshivos, and the really brilliant students, and there certainly were brilliant students, got to there, but that was a selection process. It would be like saying in the United States in the middle of the 19th century, most kids got through maybe part of elementary school, 10% maybe went to high school, and a very small fraction went to this small number of colleges that existed here. Okay. Now, next. So from here on in, I'm going to be essentially reading from one book. This is this book by Iris Tavush called Nashim Kovot. I'll be reading it mainly in Saadia's translation. His day job is he supports himself by doing respectable translating work, and he did an excellent translation of this book, so I will, it hasn't yet appeared, so I'm reading from a version of his
translation. What was he doing that? The translation.
What do you mean, was he doing
for the author?
Doing his salary for the author.
Well, for the author, not from a school or a publisher. Or
no, he
earns a living by translating books. It's a respectable living.
The person writes a book and then he turns it over to a
translator.
Yeah.
It's a profession like any other profession.
The original Hebrew?
This is the original Hebrew, I
think. Oh, from Hebrew. I thought it was Arabic.
No.
Oh, this is a book written in Hebrew whose title is Reading Women. Nashim Kovot. And we're going to see...
Why would he want to translate it? Because nobody can read the Hebrew.
There's a big market.
He translated it because he gets
paid.
I don't mean that. I mean, why would the author want to...
It's a larger market.
Why is my differential geometry book translated into Japanese and into Russian?
Because people want to know about it.
What?
Same thing.
No, I don't know.
Please pull your word.
Yes, women's education.
All right. Okay.
Must be a market for that.
All right. So, first of all, Wait for the English translation.
This came through email.
This
came run out and get it quick.
I assume that will come out in about a year. This is. Okay, so the first issue that she discusses in this book is I'm going to read from her chapter called Gender Roles. What were actually the roles of women in Jewish society in Eastern Europe at that time? And of course, from Eishes Chayil, we have two sort of contradictory roles. Towards the end, it says, "Sofia halichot beita, alecha matzlut lo tocher," that the woman's role is to supervise the home. However, the entire thrust of the rest of Eishes Chayil was quite different. Eishes Chayil mi yimtsa, v'rachok mipnei mechra, batach balei ba'ala v'shalal lel yesod. The woman's role is to bring in income into the family. V'malatu tov v'lo ra, kol yomai chayel. She engages in making a cloth. And then she engages in trade to far distances. She gets up in the middle of the night to engage in her money-earning activities. Etc. So the role of Eishes Chayil, which was the one that was in fact practiced by women in Eastern Europe was to be the money earner in the family. She has a nice quote here from Mendelssohn of Schwerin, in which he says, "Ha'isha obedet at ha'baal v'do'eget la'olam hazeh." The woman worships her husband and is concerned with matters of this world. "Ha'baal obedet ha'elohim v'do'eg la'olam haba." And this, okay. So that's the ideal family structure. So, now let me read what she has to say. Bread-winning women. Being patriarchal, Jewish traditional society, an official outlook at least, relegated women to the domestic sphere. The ideal of the woman held in view was that of a wife who looketh well to the ways of her household. And the passage from Psalms, "The full glory of the king's daughter lies within," is often approvingly cited as an apt expression of this ideal of femininity. Men in this society were charged with responsibility to the ritual and the spiritual realm, and the ideal of the male was that of a scholar bent over in study at the tent of Torah. Yet, traditional society did not everywhere insist that women satisfy this particular model of its ideal type. In practice, the model was traded in for that of a woman of valor. That is, for an ideal of the woman breadwinner who lets her husband devote all his time to the study of Torah and the fulfillment of his religious vocation. This exchange of ideals was manifested in social arrangements and practices which put women in storefronts or in the market square and regularly exposed them to contact with a non-Jewish environment. Such social arrangements were reflections of the prioritization traditional society made of its values and tutoring the value of its gender hierarchy. They expressed the preference for the spiritual over the material, the superiority of the male over the female, and the premium placed on the religious destiny which the male was meant to fulfill.
Can you explain how this squares A with the previous three?
Because the ideal never squares with the female.
Well,
okay.
So
because Jewish society depended on its female breadwinners.
Well, the point being, his father went to the shop.
Yeah.
And if they were not educated, they weren't sitting around parking cars. They might have been sitting around hanging around anyway.
Well, they were hanging around, but his father was a more modern person, and he actually went to his leather factory. He didn't have to read to be able to.
No, those are two separate issues.
Yeah. Because Jewish society depended upon its female breadwinners, it was considered an asset for a woman to have language skills necessary for commercial purposes. Much of the evidence pertaining to the gender role division in Jewish society of the period suggests a tight correlation between the phenomenon of breadwinning women and the importance assigned to proficiency in foreign languages. In his memoirs, Nachumeo Shaikowitz, Shomeo, for example, describes the values from which Jewish society's gender roles were derived as follows. In those days, the Hebrews believed that the object of the life of every Hebrew man was to be immersed in the Torah and the Talmud, and the duty of every Hebrew woman was to provide for her husband and her home. Therefore, the honest Jews prevented their sons from acquiring any science or knowledge of trade, and turned their confidence solely towards the Talmud. Yet their daughters were turned to comprehend the tongue of the land and all necessary vocational sciences to the end that they may be sufficiently wise to manage the households and businesses. Schomer's observation suggests that the women were granted instruction in secular topics in foreign languages so as to be able to fulfill their functions as breadwinners. Avram Ber Gottlober similarly relates in his memoirs that it was because of the breadwinner role Jewish society had conferred on him that possession of language skills came to be considered an asset for women. Knowledge of foreign languages increased the girl's value on the marriage market. According to Gottlober, when the time for marrying drew near, matchmakers often included language skills in their list of the prospective bride's virtues. In those days, this is a direct quote from Gottlober, the matchmakers would set eyes upon a studious youth of honorable name, and they would all scribble in their notebooks, and endless maidens would surround them, these ones beauty, those the daughters of the wealthy, others from eminent families. And each day they would mutter in the ears of the father, within the earshot of the son, that it was high time for his son was betrothed, and here's a gentle maiden who's just right for him, and none is her like for a beauty in the land, and she is fluent in Polish like water. You read Polish without Bielasa. For Polish remained then and ever after the Russian, even after the Russian eagle had spread its wings all across the land, the state tongue. And as the income of Jews in those days were earned by their wives, the women of valor, and the men sat closed in their homes or at the study halls engaged in Torah worship, knowing the Polish language was a valued skill for the maidens of Israel. And even when men, after many days, left the study of Torah and removed this crown, which did not fit on their heads, these men served merely as assistants to their wives in the shops, passing the merchandise to them, and when the Polish squire would come to purchase an item, they would fall silent or hide in the back room, but they did not know the language, and the woman alone would conduct the business at hand.
Did the girls go to the public schools?
No, most of them learned. There were no public schools. Most of them learned at home, and we'll come to see how these girls were educated. Okay.
But that sort of differs completely from that autobiography.
Why?
Because it sounds like the men are learning.
Yeah. Some are and some aren't. But they're not engaged in
talking about it. I don't
get that. Now you're talking about not the Austro-Hungarian.
Now, well, I'm now talking about Poland, a different branch of Poland.
Russian Poland.
Not Krakow.
Okay.
Not Poland?
Originally it was Poland.
The Austrian. Galicia was out of Austria-Hungary.
Here is Shomer again writing about his mother. My mother, Hadassah, was the most renowned of the women of Nisovich for her knowledge of arithmetic and four languages. Yiddish, Russian, German, and Polish. Yet my father, raised on the knees of the Torah and the Talmud, was a great scholar and very talented in clear writing in Hebrew, but all practical topics of sciences were foreign to him. He was by nature a very lackadaisical man, nachlesiger, as we say. Nachlesiger. One of the study hall regulars with her hands in the pockets who despised all work and failed at every trade, one of the ones with a living truth. With a lineage created to live at the expense of parents or in-laws. So,
what's different today?
Okay. Let's see, there's a quote from the book about Tanakh on page 15. In rabbinical texts as well, there's evidence for the readiness of traditional society to allow women to acquire a secular education that was linked to their role as breadwinners. In the introduction to his Alkot Chaim, Rav Gershon Tenach points out the inherent hazards of providing girls with a general learning and warns about the laxity and docility which traditional society is allowing its girls to acquire a secular education. He nonetheless declares unambiguously that this phenomenon is ineradicable, owing to traditional society's reliance on the breadwinning women. So now it's a quote. So with the manner of education of girls, I have seen many who have unknowingly erred by letting their girls learn alien topics, and who are deluded from that from such studies of theirs they learn only to read and to acquire the language of the peoples. For this matter, the provision is necessary to our income, and it is necessary for many girls of Israel who have to negotiate in business. Indeed, one may not issue a decree on this, most of the public would not be able to obey it. So even though it would be desirable to prevent girls from acquiring language skills in Polish and so on, nobody would listen to them because this is necessary for the girls for the year. We're talking about the middle of the 19th century.
All this business went on within the Stepford.
No. They need to know Polish because they would be training.
So all the women, the girls went to public schools?
No, there were no public schools.
So
the girls
taught the girls.
They had private tutors.
Weren't they fearful the girls would wind up intermarrying?
No, they weren't fearful.
They were the only ones having any interaction with the outside community.
Well, no, I don't think there was any danger of intermarriage, but there was danger of the girls losing their religious observance. Concept of intermarriage, I think, at that time, was, only later, Shlomo Aleichem stories at the end of the 19th century. Now, another important thing to take into account.
You would say their religious influence.
I'm simply saying, I was quoting from, I guess this must be, book here refers to the Gershon Hanef. I assume it's the Gershon Hanef line, I believe it was in the Rebbe. I assume that that's what they refer to here. And he says, you know, I didn't bother to go to the library to take out his edition of Al Kol Chayim, but basically what he's saying is that there is a clear danger in the fact that all of these Jewish parents are letting the girls learn Polish, for example, but it's absolutely necessary because they're the ones that conduct business, and there would be no income if the girls weren't able to be.
The men did not go to school every Shabbat at that time, only Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur.
That I don't know.
And they have a tenarana.
We will discuss the tenarana, certainly. That was a very crucial ingredient, and we'll come to that. But I want to contrast the education of men and the education of women. And here's one big contrast, namely the girls were allowed to learn foreign language. Another issue which cannot be ignored is the brutalization of men due to early marriage. Remember, the marriage age at this time is steadily increasing in the 19th century, but still, in the middle of the 19th century, the typical marriage age for a boy might have been 14 or 15. And,
but that's true in Jewish world as well?
No.
And the girls were also
13 or 14. Okay. So again, I'm going to, as with the phenomenon of the women breadwinners, the matrimonial practices for all their patriarchal character granted women significant degrees of freedom and placed them in a position of powers in the family. For, first, the girls remained in the bosom of their family after the wedding, at a time when boys had to detach themselves from their family's familial support structure and adjust to the trials of a new household.
They were at the in-laws.
Right. And second, the small difference in age between boy husband and girl wife, both of whom were entering adolescence, provided the wife with the advantage of the earlier maturation of girls. In Haskalic autobiographies, the experience of child marriages is described from the male perspective. The early departure from the family home, the life in the company of a child woman who matures before her husband, and the new existence under the probing eyes of an authoritarian mother-in-law who runs the family affairs. And accounts like these convey an experience of difficulty or even of trauma, and they underscore, among other things, the women's position of power. A set of conditions of this kind is described by Moshe Leib Lilienblum, 1843-1910, in his autobiographical Chatot Meruim. Nick claimed that all he sees in child marriages, he takes care to state his exact age of marriage, pointing that he was wed at the age of 15 years and 10 months to a bride aged 13 years and 4 months. The calls of Mazel Tov, which greeted the couple at the end of the wedding ceremony, he used for the bitter retrospective of his marital life. Mazel Tov to you, you blood-groom sunk in misfortune and intense misery. Mazel Tov for a life full of despair and errors of death. Mazel Tov for a tragic biography, which is merely the outcome of that same Mazel Tov. Lilienblum blames his tragic biography not only on his marriage, but on his mother-in-law specifically. No doubt the reader will have noticed that in these stories of mine, the mother-in-law seems the active character, and the father-in-law a minor figure. And so it is in fact. The husband does not wear the pants, as the expression goes, in his household, but as an adjunct to his wife. It is my mother-in-law who is this biography's creator, that is, of its tragic chapter. She removed me from my parental home and married her daughter to me when I was 15, and she, her daughter, 13, so that everyone would speak of her and her hasty wedding she engineered. It should have surprised no one if such a cursed woman was able to extend her dominion over an innocent 15-year-old boy, such as I was then, and embitter my life with her oaths and curses and with the coals that blow in his mouth. And this is typical. I don't mean to cite a whole bunch of other horror stories.
His mother was probably all 30 at the time.
Yeah.
Right.
An old woman and a 30. Right.
Some consolation, she was dead by 40.
Well, yeah.
He always.
Okay. Now let's come to your question.
What was Lillian Bloom's what the exile of a leftist kind of a guy?
Yeah, he was a leftist kind of a guy. He was a one of the masculine. I apologize, I'm quoting leftists here, like in
how come you know that?
Because there's a street named after him.
My best friends were leftists.
Okay, so now let's see a contrast between the men's education and the women's education. And here, it's really the contrast, for example, between prayers, as said by women, the primus, and prayers, as said by men. Here's a quote from Bialik that she brings. The supplications, the prinos that the women would say, was from Yiddish, of course. Reshit divra lo misod chachamim univonim unilemadad chachaminim. It doesn't start with the poetry of misod chachamim univonim, etc. Ela dvarim pshutim utmimim. Kan ein lahem lo tashrak tafas vo atbash, avo yesh kan rachamim v'tachminim shel lev dakar v'netesh mishtapechet. V'moshan rakah v'chama, v'shon aim usfat in munapshutah, vashon krobal alev, vinobat min halev. So, for example, the women who were saying the penis understood what they were saying, and it meant something to them, and they were actually, so the women, woman's literacy in Yiddish, I'm not saying that most women were literate in Yiddish, but those women who were literate in Yiddish and were able to pray in Yiddish saying the penis understood their prayers, and it touched them at a deeper spiritual level, for example, than a person coming to shul who was able to meld the words of the prayers. And like him, I'm not particularly understanding.
Well, Rob said that it wasn't Fakhana, we wouldn't know how to pray.
Yeah.
She was the first.
Right. But here I'm talking
about how to pray.
That, yes. But here I'm simply saying that there was a difference between those women who were literate were actually able to read and understand the language that they were taught. So even though it was only a minority of women who may have been literate in Yiddish, those who were literate and were able to daven and pray in Yiddish understood their prayers, and it interacted emotionally with them.
Why shouldn't they have been literate? I mean, at least understand, because that's also a language at home.
No, literate.
Literate, I know, means reading, but at least they could.
They could speak it.
They could speak it, but they understand it, right?
Right. But
and understand it.
Absolutely. But now when they learned to read it, it was a living language, a language which they could understand. Whereas the boy, like Innfeld, who went to Cheder,
didn't understand the Hebrew.
Didn't understand the Hebrew, and he didn't understand the Ivritaych, which was an ancient Yiddish. It would be sort of like translating from Latin into Chaucer.
The answer partly his question. They had readers.
Yes, I'll get to the Zogarin.
Santa Rena,
Yes.
They knew the language, but they couldn't read it.
But those who could read it. Yeah. So let me read what Dr. Parrish has to say. As was already noted, boys acquired their literacy skills communally in the institutionalized and obligatory studying of the Cheder, whereas many of the girls who learned to read gained their reading ability privately or in the company of a relative or a family member. Girls learned the alphabet in voluntary and informal study frameworks from the rabbi's wife and the cheder for girls, from a private tutor, or for patiently listening to the studies of the boys. I don't know if you ever saw that movie, Tevye.
The original,
huh? What?
Tevye,
the
original.
Tevye was a musical made out of the original
Sholem Aleichem,
but there was a great Yiddish movie with Maurice Schwartz playing the role of Tevye.
This is on my time.
There's one that recently she wanted to become a yeshiva boy.
Yeah, but I'm talking about
the end.
I guess you haven't seen that movie. Okay. Girls learned the alphabet in voluntary and informal study frameworks from the rabbi's wife and the cheder for girls, from a private tutor, or from patiently listening to the study of the boys. Boys were required to spend a long school day in the cheder, while girls usually studied in brief periods. In theory, these differences should have given boys the advantage. Yet a glance at the notes about the cheder studies, in which the autobiographies of the period are full of, suffices to establish that quite often things were otherwise. Many describe the cheder period as a difficult and even traumatic experience, as we just saw from Professor Infeld. The physical conditions in the instructor's filthy and unkempt tiny apartment were, on the whole, those of severe and cramped poverty. Many instructors were ignorant and rude. Their teaching was done by rote, not infrequently with the assistance of blows and other forms of violence. A typical enough description of experience studying the cheder is given by Buki Ben Yadri, if this is Dr. Katznelson, who we quote many times in this year, but not in his pseudonym of use for looking at Al-Yagri, but in his book, Al-Talmud, Al-Hakmat, Al-Tawar, etc. From the abyss of nothingness, this is book Ibn Yagri writing, from the abyss of nothingness now arises in my memory a low and narrow house full of smoke and poisonous vapors, with a large stove near the opening of the house to heat the surroundings. On the stove and on the bed by the side, the family of the instructor swarms and roils about, a choir of half-naked children, shoving and quarreling, a long and thin woman with a man's face and eyes that drip fury. Between her knees, she squeezes a very large goose. With one hand, she grips its head in open beak, and with the other, she packs into it round stuffing balls from the dish in front of her. The instructor, a thin and black man with a long, scraggly beard that twitches in synchrony to the leather strap in his hands, and with which he calls his people's attention to his message. I fail to rightly translate a passage from Rashi, and suddenly I sense the leather strap stinging my frail shoulders. Once, twice, once, and once thrice. The instructor grew savage and showered on me a fever of curses and unspeakable invectives. Say, Golem, put, hook, glut, put, gavet, to motion, mit harwav out. But aching intensely, I had no spirit left and remained silent. Yes, not for the first time, I tasted the flavor of the instructor's strap. Every Friday at noon, before the instructor would send us home, he would on us, all of us pupils, without exception, a set number of lashes, which lashes were given a special name, Freidachschnitz.
How is this different than Dickens? Same idea.
We thought these beatings. So these were the lashes of Erev Shabbos. We thought these beatings were a sort of ancient religious custom dating from the days of Cain and Abel.
Memorable.
In view of this description and others like it, one may say that by contrast with the boys' study in the cheder, the girls' reading instruction took place in a comfortable environment, free of pressures and anxieties, a result of which was that the girls did not tend to associate learning to read with the experience of shame and humiliation, the lot of more than a few boys. Moreover, the short period devoted to learning to read for girls was often much more efficiently utilized than the longer times devoted to it in the cheder for boys, and the reading abilities of girls did not fall beneath those of boys.
Nobody disputes this stuff.
It just came out. The book just came out. If you want to dispute it,
I can't believe it.
She's quoting other people, you know. She was quoting other people.
She's quoting Bookie Ben Yagli. I trust him. Professor Dr. Katznelson. And I also, even though Infeld was a leftist, nevertheless, I think
that it's that goes with it, right?
Yeah. Excuse
me, Rabbi, how about Bialik? I mean, he wrote a Masbit and so forth, and it wasn't always favorable.
No.
But it had feeling that they were learning, but never heard of this teacher killing them all the time. I don't know, this sounds
okay.
Very strange.
Okay. A further barrier to understanding the biblical text and its language was the non-sequential understanding of instruction of the five books. Each week at Cheder, usually only on Thursday evenings and Fridays, the first section of that week's Torah portion was taught. The following week, they began on the next week's Torah portion, without filling in the gaps from the previous weeks. This custom of skipping text left gaps in the narrative continuity of the five books and prevented students from recognizing the full narrative context of the weekly portion. It is worth stressing that even students of the more advanced yeshivas had trouble understanding the Bible and its language. Yalag, that's Yehudaleh Gordon, relates that even his yeshiva colleagues who had been training since early infancy to be leading rabbis did not understand the scripture and could not read verses in the original. This was occasionally the source of embarrassment during the Talmud reading classes. Though the Talmud stories were full of biblicisms, we used to skip past them in front of our rabbis, or run through them in a single breath. Yet, when there was some tough, unavoidable verse stuck in a legal passage, it got stuck like a bone in their throats. Mendela also attests to the same phenomenon. Yet with anyone in those days, he should study Bible beyond the first fragment of the weekly portion. The fathers will help from the children not only reason, but also the Bible. And those who studied it were suspected of apostasy. The matter was most perplexing, and of the 150 excuses given for not one justly resolved the issue in Israel's favor. And while many will not believe this, yet thus it was in fact, and thus in our sins it remains among Jews even today. In the past, the rabbis were not versed in the Bible, and even today many rabbis do not understand Scripture in the original. And nevertheless, one must not question them, God forbid, doubtless they have reasons which the simple soul is incapable of refuting. And perhaps it is possible to be a certified expert in Torah and a teacher of teachers without even knowing a verse of the Hebrew writings. Unlike the boys, the girls who learned to read, as said, Yiddish, that is a living, spoken language, which they regularly spoke and entirely understood. As a result, these girls had a good understanding of what they read, and they read sympathetically and with pleasure. This reading comprehension ability gave them an advantage over the boys, even in terms of familiarity with the tales of the five books. Unlike many of the boys, they were able to read the five books in their entirety, accompanied by fables and homilies out of San Lorena, and many knew these tales well. In his autobiography, Bukim Yagli presents an instructive account of this difference between the girls and the boys in Jewish society, and he relates that only by means of the Tzenna Orena, that his grandmother read, that is mediated by the woman's presence and her books, could he gain experience of reading the five books and begin to fill in the gaps in his Cheder studies had left. And there's another quote from Bukim Ben Yagli. The Tzenna Orena really opened my eyes. As I noted above, in the Cheder, I studied only discontinuous sections of the five books with no relation or connection between them. Through the Tzenna Orena, a complete and elaborate picture from the lives of our ancestors was revealed before me, a picture seasoned with a fine, refined, and wonderful fables that captured my heart. With the supplications, too, the inferior feminine substitute for prayers, women enjoyed less onerous obligations and a fuller degree of comprehension than the men. The prayers are for the most part formulated in the plural. They speak in the name of all of Israel and on its behalf, whereas the supplications of women are cast in the singular and are characterized by an intimate and personal tone. Often there was even a space left in the supplication for a woman to insert her name, so-and-so, daughter of so-and-so, in the supplications recited. Unlike the men, the women were not bound to an obligatory prayer schedule and they could pray in their homes whenever they felt the need. No less important is the fact that the women were not bound to a fixed version of the prayer. The Book of Supplication, that is the Tchinus, partly composed or revised by women, were arranged in an order that suited the routine of women's lives and plumed themselves on their correspondence to life's ranging vagaries. And in contrast, and the women who understood the words of these supplications were free to choose for themselves the ones that faithfully expressed their particular exigencies, worries, and aspirations. And I think we'll continue next week, but you see that the picture of what the educational situation was for women in the 19th century is far more complicated and intricate than simply reading what it says in the Shulchan Aruch and in the practical texts. And what effect this had at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, we will continue on in your session next year.
Interesting.
What if the
ancient history? Why do we keep them back?
They do it in Muncie now.
No, it's in Yiddish, but they understand the Yiddish.
No. Kids come from English, I don't know, but they come from English-speaking houses, and they go to first grade, and they learn the Torah with Yiddish types.
I presume they also learn English, too, so they know that.
No, I think
I don't
linear
think so, no.
They
learn Torah with Yiddish types. I don't think English comes up in the school.
They're not learning anymore.
Except for shut
they're
up and sit down.
They're not learning anymore.
Well, or just to read and write at the school.
I'm
going to
say it. I remember.